Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. For this week's episode, as you guys heard in the follow-up, when Zach and I were discussing the elements of this case, we have discovered that it is incredibly difficult to find accurate information about the case that is sourced back to an actual case file. The name Dr. Sandra Lean came up in that conversation as who seems to be very possibly one of the, if not the only person who actually has the case file, has studied it, and has been working on this case for years. So with that information, one of our listeners had reached out to Dr. Lean. She reached out to me, and rather than me sort of explaining what I think happened and then bringing her on to correct me, we decided to skip a step, and I am joined today by the author of the book Innocence Betrayed, Dr. Sandra Lean. Dr. Lean, thank you so much for taking the time to clear all of this up for us.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll get right into it. So our plan here is we're going to kind of stick right with our format where today, first of all, there may be some corrections and stuff we've already covered, but we're going to move right through the discovery of Jody's body, the condition of her body, and the investigation that night with Luke and the family and everyone with the police. And then Dr. Lean has graciously agreed to join me again as we move on to talk about, in another episode, the case against Luke. And then the case for innocence. But today we're gonna try to kind of stay focused on the facts of the things that happened that night. So, Dr. Lean, before we get into that, do you want to briefly explain to the audience kind of who you are and how you came to be connected with this case?
Yes, I had nothing to do with the law, justice, anything like that in the beginning. I just happened to live in the adjoining village to where Jody was murdered, and my daughter attended the high school that Jody was found behind. So it concerned me that they had jumped so immediately to the conclusion that it was this 14-year-old boy. And what if it wasn't?
Right. And so what is it? You're a doctor, or I don't know if it's a PhD, or are you a medical doctor? What is your background?
No, PhD in criminology. My first degree was in psychology and sociology. I then went on and studied for a specialist paralegal degree, diploma, and then went on and did my PhD.
Oh, wow. And so all of that began, was it because of this case or just after this case?
The paralegal and the PhD were because of this case. The psychology and sociology I'd done before.
So how did you, other than your interest in the case, which obviously led to your furthering education, how did you get connected to the case in a way where you were actually able to obtain access to some of the case file?
Back then, there were very, very few people in the local area, even considering that he might be innocent. Mm-hmm. So Luke's mum heard my take just through local gossip, really.
Okay.
Put a note through the door of my workplace and asked if I could help them. And at the beginning, I had no idea how I could do that. But then over time, I had to learn the different justice systems, because in the UK, we have 3 in total. So I had to learn the different justice systems to make sure I wasn't guiding them through a justice system that didn't apply here in Scotland.
Sure.
And then from there, I started working with a couple of the lawyers that were involved in the case. And that's how I ended up with access to the case files.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm glad you did, because that's things are so different here in the United States. When I work a case here, I file a request, I get the full case file, and that's what we work off of. And so that's, you know, when I started working on this case, I kept, well, sooner or later, I'll find this case file. Someone has this case file, right? And no, it's not the case over there in Scotland.
No, they're not made public over here at all. Certain documents, like the appeal documents, are made public, but that's it. Trial transcripts are massively expensive, hugely expensive. And although I have the defense papers, it's actually an offense for me to share them with third parties who are not directly working on the case.
Wow.
So if I were to put them online, for example, they're going to come for me.
Right, right.
As simple as that. Wow. And that's why I can take excerpts and I can show excerpts. But the minute I start to put full documents out, that's when I've crossed the line.
Wow, that seems so difficult to have any real accountability for the justice system when the public is never allowed to see what actually happened. That's amazing. Well, let's get right into this. So last week in my episode, I kind of walked through the timeline of the different phone calls. And a lot of that was, and stuff that's noted in your book, is that there's a whole lot of confusion surrounding the timeline, because the family, not just the family, everybody except Luke, there's sort of stories and accounts of the day keep changing. The 4:50 time, the 5 o'clock, or the 5:30 time when Jody left. So we kind of left that open-ended, where we really don't know, other than originally it seemed like it was 5:30. Then later the story became 4:50. One thing that was asked from some of my listeners this week was, I had touched on last week that there were people that saw Luke sitting on a wall in New Battle. So we talked a little about that, and we'll get more into that next week. But then the question was, it was said that he, at some point during that night, was hanging out with some friends at the Abbey, and they asked, like, did his friends that were with him at the Abbey ever give statements? And if so, what did they say about it? Like, what time did he get there, and what was his demeanor and everything?
Yeah, so the Abbey is directly opposite the wall at the end of the street where you've seen sitting.
Yeah.
And he was waiting for Jody, and she didn't show, and eventually thought he'd been stood up.
Mm-hmm.
So he went over into the Abbey to meet these three friends. One of them eventually at trial said that Luke had told him Jody wasn't coming out that evening.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecution point being, how could he possibly have known that?
Right.
When she was coming down to meet him. The other two boys didn't just say, don't know. The other two boys said, he said nothing of the sort.
Okay.
And he only brought the boy who said he said Jody wasn't coming to give evidence. So again, it's this absence thing.
Right.
If the other two boys who were quite clear.
Were they at least able to nail down a time, like a time window when he was at the Abbey?
Yes, he met the boys just after 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And he was with, one of them had to go home about 8:30, mm-hmm, because he was only 11.
Okay.
So little, really little kid, who had tagged along with one of the older boys.
Uh-huh.
So he and the older boy that he'd come with left at 8:30. The other boy stayed with Luke until round about 9:10, 9:15. Yeah, they weren't looking at the watches, but it was round about that time.
Okay. So they all seem to agree Luke got there at around 7?
Yeah.
Okay. At what time was the sighting of him where people saw him sitting on the wall?
He was seen on the wall at about 5 to 6.
Okay.
And then about 20 minutes later by boys who knew him from school. So they'd cycled past him on their way into Dalkeith.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them got a puncture and had to push his bike all the way home.
Okay.
About 20 minutes later. So when he came back the other way, Luke was still sitting on the wall. There is a witness who said she saw him near an opening to some houses round about 6:30.
Okay.
Now, this little opening's a few yards from where he lives, but it's at the bend in the road where, mm-hmm, he could have looked round to see if Jody was coming. And he said he walked up to that entrance to look round to see if there was any sign of Jody. That was 6:30. And this other witness, a woman in a car, said she saw him there at 6:30, or somebody that looked like him, because she didn't know.
So the idea is, if we're looking at an innocent Luke, is that he has dinner at his house around 5:30. He goes down and waits at the wall, waits for a while until about 6:30, and then he looks to see if she's coming down the path, and then he just goes up to the Abbey and hangs out with his friends.
Yeah.
So now we'll jump to, we went through all the different timelines at night, and you know, around 11 o'clock, the family ends up meeting Luke at the entrance to the Ronsdyke path. And I kind of gave the version that I was familiar with there, but I think it's better off here to kind of reset that and have you just walk us through from the minute Luke meets Jody's family at the entrance of the path, kind of walk us through the rest of the events that followed after that.
Yeah, if we can start just before that.
Okay.
the three members of Jodie's family, we call them the search trio because there were four of them in the search party. So the search trio and family members. From what they said in statements, first of all, they had no idea that Jodie was going to be anywhere near the path that night.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the time they gave for leaving from Jodie's mother's house, there was no way they could have got from there to the top of the path in time to meet Luke. And Luke's timings are confirmed. So it's just important to bear that in mind. But Luke had said to Jodie's mum, he would come up the path that Jodie would have taken to come down. And if he didn't find her, he would make his way to the mum's house where grown-ups would decide what to do next. He was a 14-year-old boy.
Right.
He gets two-thirds of the way up the path and there are people at the entrance to the path. And Jodie's gran shouts out, "Is that you, Luke?" Mm-hmm. And they waited for Luke to meet them. Then they had this conversation about, did they have anything off Jodie's for the dog to scent?
Mm-hmm.
Because the gran had suggested a double check. But they didn't have anything of Jodie's and they just turned and went back down the path. Luke had just come up.
Okay.
To do this double check. And a lot of people have said, why did the dog not react on the way up the path when Luke was on his own? And Luke has always said from the very beginning, she may well have done. She was really excited. He was flustered because, Jodie's missing.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog was bouncing about. He said if she jumped at the wall, he would just have pulled it away.
Right.
Because she wasn't looking for anything. They were just going up the path. And if Jodie was somewhere on the path, he'd get her and take her to her mum's. And if not, our mum would decide what to do next.
Speaking of the dog, we had a conversation about the dog in our Friday's episode. There was question about one of our co-hosts was asking about, if he had trained the dog, if the dog could find someone just based on a command, find Jodie as opposed to a scent. After we were done recording, someone had told me, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, that either at trial or at some point, some expert had, I guess, checked out Mia to see what her skills were. And what I was told was that they said she's actually exceptionally trained. Does any of that ring a bell?
It's a little bit mixed up, but on the right tracks, the gentleman who was training Mia, and it was purely for a hobby. She wasn't being trained to be a working dog, but he'd been training military dogs for over 20 years. And he was a neighbor and he spotted Mia's ability and approached Luke and his mum and said, "Do you want to give her a try and, see how well she does?"
Okay.
And it was he who said in his statement, this dog had exceptional abilities. So that's where that came from.
Is he the one that was training the dog or was Luke training the dog?
The neighbor was training the dog, but he was also training Luke and Cory, Luke's mum, to train the dog as well so that he could step out and the dog would respond to them.
Oh, okay. Okay, so now they're at the end of the path. They decide to go back and take a second look down the path, and that's when Luke tells Mia to go find Jodie, and they start walking down the path.
Yeah, and they make their way down the path. This V point that everybody talks about, the V break in the wall, it's simply because that's the only bit on that area of the path that you could get over the wall to the other side.
Okay.
The wall's about 7 feet high.
Okay.
And the V comes down to about 4 feet above ground level, so you could get through there.
Uh-huh.
Luke's story is that Mia passed the V and then jumped up and started scrabbling at the wall and ear sniffing.
Okay.
And he recognized that as an alert, doubled back, handed the dog's lead to Jodie's gran, who'd fallen behind,
mm-hmm.
went over the wall and turned left in the direction that the dog had reacted, and that's when he found Jodie. Her sister and her sister's boyfriend agreed for the first month in their statements that that is exactly what happened, to the extent that the sister's boyfriend describes the dog, saying it's a big dog, it's an Alsatian. When it was standing up at the V, its head was higher than the V. It's a very, very clear description.
And that's in his police interview?
Yes.
Okay.
Nan said that she couldn't see because they'd gone ahead of her and she'd fallen behind, so she couldn't see what the dog did. By the time we get to the end of July, the first month, the search trio start to change the stories about what the dog did. And by the time we get to trial, the dog did nothing. There's no reaction from the dog. Luke went straight to the V and over the wall. And yet we have these descriptions. The sister said the dog started going crazy and jumping about at the wall. The boyfriend gives this description, and then at trial, nothing.
I'm stopping myself from jumping ahead because I have a lot of questions about how that works when we get to the how that happened at trial. But we'll save that for another day. But so if we're working off the first month's worth of statements from everybody, everybody agrees the dog is jumping and going crazy at the wall. Luke goes over. There seemed to be a little confusion there. So he saw Jody's body, and then he comes back and tells Stephen that he found something, but he doesn't say what. Is that right?
He calls out from the other side of the wall.
Okay.
I think there's something here. And Stephen and Janine have continued down the path.
Uh-huh.
So past where the dog reacted, they're still going down. And Luke calls out, I think there's something here. By their statements, they ran back to the V in the wall.
Uh-huh.
Stephen goes over. Luke's still at the V, but on the woodland side.
Uh-huh.
Stephen goes down to exactly the same point that Luke did. And if you look at the descriptions, they describe exactly the same tree and how they have to take a step to the ground. Uh-huh. In order to be able to see the body. They both describe the same injuries, the blood on the neck, the fact that she was naked, the fact that she was looking upwards. So they've obviously seen the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then the gran is very, very agitated and demands to be helped over the wall so that she can go and see what's there for herself. So that's the three of them, Luke, Stephen Kelly, and the gran. All go down, but the gran goes further than the boys. She goes right up to the body. And in the early days, the claim was that she cradled Jodie's body. And again, the statements changed later to she touched Jodie's forehead. So there's a difference in the physical contact there.
Can you talk us through the whole 999 calls? Because that was confusing. So Luke is the one that first called 999.
Yes. So when Alice comes back up, Luke's calling 999 while Alice is coming back up.
Mm-hmm.
And he just says, can you ask the police to get here? We've found something. And the operator says, oh, the lad is in a bit of state. He's agitated, but he won't say what he found. So Alice gets over the wall, and 3 minutes after Luke calls, the police call him back and say, where are you? We've got police officers there and we can't find you. And then 6 minutes after that, Stephen Kelly dials 999 and he's screaming at the police. It's an effing body. You need to get here. They're supposed to be meeting us. Now, what he said was they were in the mother's house. We phoned an hour ago. They were supposed to be meeting us here. Now, those three statements, if you just stop and think about it, how can that possibly be? Unless he's talking about Luke's call, when they called Luke back at 11:38 saying, where are you? How could there be an agreement to meet the search trio that was made an hour earlier when they just found Jodie's body? It makes no sense. And I have the full transcript of those phone calls.
So much of this makes no sense. So when Stephen called, so we have Luke calls and says, we found something. Get here. They call him back and they say, where are you?
Yeah.
Then Stephen calls them and he says, there's a body. You're supposed to meet us at the path.
Yeah. We phoned an hour ago. This is the important bit. We called an hour ago. They were supposed to be meeting us here.
Oh, okay. So he specifically said in the transcript that he told the 999 operator that we called an hour ago and you're supposed to meet us at this location, which is where the body was found.
And that's 11 minutes after they found the body.
Interesting. Well, that's definitely something to we'll sink our teeth into a little bit more next week. Let's talk about, so the police get there and And there's some confusion about who found the body, because from what I read, the police think that Luke was alone when he found the body, and they end up talking to the family at a different location. How did all that happen?
When the police finally found them, and they weren't that far away, they were only about maybe 700 yards away, but there are two paths at right angles to each other, and the police have gone at right angles to Rowan's dyke path rather than coming down the path. So once they figured that out, of course, they made a beeline for where they'd been told they were. But when they arrived, they seemed to be of the impression that Luke and Luke alone had found the body, and the other three had arrived after Luke found the body. Because one of them radios in, and he said, there's three others here, the sister, our boyfriend, and the gran. We think the boyfriend's found it. We're just getting the gran and the others, just getting their names.
Yeah, but they were all there together, what happened.
Yeah, there's that sense that, but the original operator who's passing information between Luke, not Stephen Kelly, Luke, and the officers on the ground, refers to everything in the singular. He says he's found something. He says, get there quickly. So it sounds the whole time like there's only one person there.
That makes sense. So that's why they thought there was only one person yes. there. Is that why? So I also read that then when they go to the police station, they take the family, the trio, and in one vehicle to all go to the police station to give statements. And then Luke is taken separately right there from the scene. Is that accurate?
Almost. They take Luke almost immediately, within 20, half an hour maximum, probably 20 minutes. Luke's in the police car and he's gone. And he's gone to a different police station on his own. They then leave the family in the car park behind the school for another 2 hours. And lots of members of Jodie's family arrive and they're all mingling for 2 hours. And then they take the whole lot up to the East House's police station, get there and think, no, actually, we don't want everybody's statements. We just want our mum and our mum's partner's statements, because they still haven't realised that the search trio are important. So they keep the mum and the mum's partner in the police station and they drive the search trio back to the mum's house, again, where all the other family members are gathered. And they don't realise till 5 o'clock in the morning that they should get statements from the search trio.
Wow. So it's starting to shed some light on why there was so much confusion around yeah. all of this. So they didn't even get statements from the other three people that were there until 5 in the morning.
No. And the police officer, the main police officer in court, actually said, we didn't realize there was a significant, we didn't know they'd been over the wall.
Okay. That makes sense. So meanwhile, at the time I had read was 11:55 p.m., Luke's taken to the police station.
11:55, by 11:55, they were all in the car park. So they'd taken the trio to the car park.
Okay.
Luke was left behind because the officer wanted him to come back over the wall and show him where Jodie's body was, and he refused. So this officer goes over the wall, leaves Luke on the path on his own. He's the youngest of the search party. Leaves him on his own. Finds Jodie, radios in and goes, yeah, it's a body. Comes back over the wall and then takes Luke up. So by 5 to midnight, they're all in the car park. Luke's sitting on the pavement beside Stephen Kelly and they're smoking a cigarette. And that's when the officer comes and tells Luke to get in the police car. And there's a bit of to-ing and fro-ing there. His mum's trying to call him. The policeman takes his phone off him, switches it off, then switches it back on and tells him to dial his mum's number so that the policeman can tell her to come to the police station, switches his phone back off again, puts it in his pocket again. So there's no forensic care being taken with this phone whatsoever. And off he goes by, I would say, 12:15 at the latest. He's gone.
And the police officer has his phone.
Yeah.
So real quick, because that was another thing that came up. I was told that there was an expert that examined the phone to look for the text messages and that they had testified to or stated that the text messages to and from Judith were deleted off of Luke's phone sometime after 12:30 a.m. the next day. Is that true, accurate?
The call logs were deleted after 12:30, yes. But what that expert said was it may have been the opening of the phone and the attempts to interrogate the phone that deleted everything. So they can't say they were deleted after that. They could have been deleted earlier, or it could have been the action of opening the phone to get the data from it that deleted everything. And he says that in his report.
And that happened after. Essentially what I'm getting at is Luke did not delete that log. It was in the officer's possession when the log was deleted. Was there, I've had a million questions about the text on Judith's phone side. Those were never, it was never figured out what happened with those either?
No, the content was never recovered. The details of the texts were on the phone logs. So Luke's number and the time.
The time that it happened, right.
But the actual content was never recovered.
Okay. So when Luke gets to, we got kind of parallel things happen here, and we'll go with Luke first, and then I want to go back to the body. So Luke is there for, till what, 6 in the morning, about 6 hours. What goes on during his time at the police station?
When he first arrived, the police stripped him and put him in the white paper suit. His mum hadn't arrived yet. They knew she was coming, but these two officers just stripped him there and then. His mum arrived. They called in a police doctor to examine him for injuries, any fresh bruises, scratches, cuts, anything like that. Swabbed him for DNA, took hair samples, photographed his entire body, looking for anything that might connect him to the crime. And then they basically questioned him and his mum till it was actually almost 7 o'clock in the morning. But interestingly, they didn't interview them together. They separated them. They were in the same room, but Luke was speaking to one officer at this end of the room and his mum was speaking to a different officer at that end of the room. So right from that point, there's no support for this 14-year-old kid.
Right.
Not even got his mum sitting beside him while he's being questioned. And then they kicked him out at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I guess the family just thought that's what happens immediately after the body's found. That's how it's done because they didn't know how these things work.
Yeah. And so in the US, that type of treatment to me would indicate that they were treating him as a suspect, not as a witness at that point. Is that accurate in Scotland too? That's not how you treat a witness.
No. And the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission, which is the body that looks at cases where there might be a miscarriage of justice, agreed that Luke was a suspect from the minute he was put in that police car and driven away, and the other three searchers were left to go about their business.
So here's a question that's just about the different countries and the law. So in the United States, if that's the case, if it's determined he's a suspect, then he's required, here we call it Mirandize, but he's required to be made aware of his rights, and he's allowed to have a lawyer. He doesn't have to speak. Is there something similar to that in Scotland because he was a suspect where he should have been allowed to have a lawyer?
Well, there is now, but back in 2003, we had what were called Section 14 interviews, and only in Scotland. They don't have them anywhere else in the UK.
Okay.
The Section 14 interview allows the police to bring someone in for questioning for up to 7 hours with no access to legal advice or representation, including children.
Wow. So there was, technically, they didn't violate any laws by doing this, having him there with...
Not at the time, no.
Wow. That's unfortunate. I thought we had problems here. yeah. So during those, that he's being interrogated, all this is happening. Was there anything that he said, any admissions during that interview or any forensics they found on him during that was incriminating, that was a use at trial?
Nothing. The same is true of the 4th of July when they raided his house and took him in for a second. So we also had a thing in Scotland that they could do before a Section 14 interview, which was a voluntary attender interview, where they don't keep them for 7 hours. they can go whenever they please. But when you look at how these interviews are carried out, there's no way they're going to just get up and walk out.
Right.
It's not going to happen. But again, no lawyer. So the night Jodie, well, into the morning after Jodie was found and the 4th of July, there was nothing in anything he said that was in any way incriminating, and there was no forensic evidence, not at the crime scene and not after they raided his house on the 4th. There was nothing.
I had read that it was noted that his hair was dirty. There was dirt under his feet. Basically, there was no indication that he had cleaned himself up or taken a shower.
No. No. Good deal of evidence that he hadn't.
Right. And that's a great transition back to the condition of Jodie's body. So I've heard lots of things. I've heard there was sexual assault. I heard there wasn't sexual assault. I've heard lots of things. So you actually know the answers to this. So what do we know about Jodie's body?
She had been quite severely beaten, badly bruised. Her hair had been pulled out in clumps. She'd been dragged by the hair. That much was very clear. There was what was believed to be a bite mark or an upper teeth imprint on the back of one of her hands. She had extensive defense injuries, horrific defense injuries. She had been strangled. They don't know if that was manually or using a ligature, but they don't believe the strangulation killed her. And then the cutthroat injuries that did kill her, between 12 and 20 cutthroat wounds, virtually decapitating her. Then, now the prosecution claim is after that, the attacker stripped her, tied her hands behind her back with her own trousers, and then mutilated her body by cutting round her eyes, slashing open her face from her lip almost to her ear, massive slash mark on her breast, and two slash marks on her abdomen. I have since seen the reports, and this is horrific. But the wound from the lip almost to the ear, which was right through, was not post-mortem.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
So she's got 12 to 20 stab wounds in the neck that I believe that's what the cause of death was.
Yeah.
Which to me would indicate that would have been, there'd been heavy, you know, if they cut her carotid arteries, there should be heavy bleeding from that. And they believe there were, other than the cut on her, from her lip to her ear through the cheek, that one was perimortem before she was dead. But the rest of the injuries to the body, they think were postmortem wounds.
Most of them, the defense wounds were before. And again, they are extensive. That one of the cuts in her arm is through to the bone. So that again would have bled a great deal. So it's an enormous injury. And then they decide that the killer wouldn't necessarily be covered in blood.
That's an interesting take. I mean, this is a very, just from my experience, this is a very up close and personal attack. You have major arteries being severed, and especially a wound to the arm. When you're flinging your arms around, I would think that the killer would be, they would have blood all over them.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm getting ahead of myself, but at trial, their case was that the killer wouldn't have had blood on them.
Not necessarily.
Right. Because of course Luke didn't have blood on him.
Yeah.
And now what I didn't know. So when she was found, her hands were tied behind her back with her own trousers.
Yeah.
Okay. And was she fully nude, or did she have any clothing on?
The only clothing she had on were her socks, and they were only half on. So they were on from over her toes to the middle of her foot, and then folded back on themselves.
Where were her clothes found, or were they?
They were scattered around the area where her body was found.
Okay. Did they do a kit to figure out if there had been any sexual assault?
There appeared, it's a really difficult one. There appeared to be no evidence of rape. For me, a 14-year-old girl stripped naked with a breast cut, there's a sexual element to it.
Yeah, that is a sexual assault.
Yeah, and then when you take into account that there was a condom with fresh semen within 20 yards of the body, for me, at the very least, sexual attack or a sexually motivated attack should have been right at the top of the list. And for the police, initially, it was. And then they dropped it.
Do you know the so when they determined there was no evidence of sexual assault, was that as simple as there was no semen found in her, or through examination of the area they determined that? I don't.
Yeah. No bruising or abrasion consistent with forced sexual intercourse.
So I assume they would testify to this if they're being intellectually honest, that not seeing obvious signs of penetrative sexual assault doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't happen.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did they at least concede to that it could have, but it just, they didn't.
No.
So they, okay.
Sorry. I really wish I could be more positive, but no, they didn't. They did try to investigate the possibility of rape with a condom not leaving the sorts of injuries they seem to be expecting there to be. It's the most bizarre thing. But then they dropped that as well. They got so far with it. And then they just decided it was not a sexual assault. And in doing that, dropped any possibility that it was a sexually motivated assault. And again, these are two different things.
Right.
But they dropped both.
Just curious, and this is again me getting ahead of myself, but did they drop the sexual assault angle before or after they realized that the semen in the condom didn't belong to Luke?
It must have been after. Because they didn't know who it did belong to. They just knew it didn't belong to Luke.
Right.
I'm just trying to think from memory the timing of the various events.
That's usually when we say wrongful convictions here in the States, you find things like that they find a piece of evidence that they're sure is connected to the crime. They have their suspect. They test it. It's not theirs. And suddenly now it's not part of the crime anymore.
Well, the 14th of July seems to have been the turning point when the first forensics came back and there was nothing on Luke. And if you look back at the media coverage, that's when the whole narrative from the police started to change as well.
Mm-hmm.
So all the original beliefs about maybe it was somebody that was sexually embarrassed in the woods and all of this, that all just goes away after the results come back.
That's kind of how I figured that happened. So is she, one more question about that. So was she found on her back or face down?
Neither. She was on her side with her upper body twisted sort of upwards. So lying, she'd been lying on her side clearly. And when she was found, her lower body was still on her side with her upper body.
It's kind of twisted.
Sort of upwards. But no, she was neither on her back nor face down.
I had also read that there were some complications with the medical examiner that, and this sounds crazy, and I'm hoping you're telling me this is wrong because it's crazy. And the way you're smiling, I'm assuming it's not. I had read that the medical examiner couldn't get over the wall that night, so they just left her body in the woods overnight.
Yes.
Was anybody guarding the body?
Well, apparently there was a policeman guarding the scene the whole night, but there was no tent put over Jodie's body. She was left out in the elements. And the officer that was supposed to be guarding the scene said nobody had entered the scene until about 5 o'clock in the morning, when we know that the police photographers had been over there. The first forensic team had been over there before 5 o'clock. Not the forensics team who actually examined the site, I have to point out. And these were guys that were brought by the senior investigating officer. So there'd been several people over the wall, and the guy that's meant to be guarding the body says there's been nobody there till 5 o'clock in the morning.
So he's either sleeping on the job, not there, or lying.
Yeah, yeah.
And it rained. It should be pointed out, it rained that night. So
it did, yeah.
Her body had been rained on by the time the medical examiner gets there to examine her. Did they at least get crime scene photos taken prior to that?
The crime scene photographs are very interesting because Jodie's body had been rolled onto a plastic sheet at some point while the photographs were being taken. So we have some photographs where she's clearly on the ground and there's leaves and, you know, what you'd expect to find in a woodland strip. And then she's turned over and she's on a plastic sheet. And the forensics guys haven't got there yet. It was one of the big criticisms at trial.
Yeah.
The forensic officer who finally got there at 8 o'clock the following morning, he was very kind to them. He said, it was not an ideally managed crime scene.
That's quite an understatement.
Yep.
Was her, and I think this is about as far as we're going to go today, but with her body, was there blood on her body? Was there blood on her clothes? I think you had mentioned that it looked like she was dressed when she was, or I had read that she was dressed when she was killed and then stripped. Does that seem to be right?
I still can't quite figure it out. When she was found, her entire upper body was clean of blood that had flowed.
Mm-hmm.
Completely clean. Now, if her throat was cut when she was sitting or kneeling, which was the claim, you would have expected at least some of the blood to have gone down the way and soaked through her clothing.
Yeah.
But her bra is almost untouched by blood. There's a couple of contact stains on it. The t-shirt is very heavily bloodstained. Her hoodie, one side of her hoodie, is very heavily bloodstained. But by the time you get to the bra and the body, there's virtually nothing. And there was no blood in the ground where she was found. And there's a blood spray on the wall, which they tried to say was arterial spray. Nothing of the sort. Far, far, far too little. Far too fine. There is no way that is arterial spray. So where's the blood and why is she so clean of blood?
But it sounds like we can deduce that if her hoodie and her shirt were covered in blood and they weren't on her, that she was wearing them when she was killed.
Yes. My feeling is not necessarily, she wasn't necessarily wearing them as she would do normally, as in they may have been pulled up as if to pull them over her head.
Which might explain why the bra didn't have blood soaked through it.
Yeah.
What about, was there blood on the trousers that were binding her hands?
Yes, there was no blood in the knots or the twists. So that would suggest that no blood had been deposited there prior to the tying of the hands. There are drips and splashes on the trousers, but nothing that you would call heavily bloodstained. So again, claim that she was sitting or kneeling for her trousers to have escaped.
Yeah, well, and if there's no blood inside the knots, that would, to me, that would indicate that her pants were off and her hands had been bound prior to her throat being slit, yeah. Which makes sense because why would you bind a dead person's hands?
Yes. It's not the prosecution case. It's the logical case, but it's not the prosecution case.
Well, that is a perfect time to stop in a good transition, because what I would like to do next week is get into, because everything we've heard so far, at least for me, from my perspective, this sounds insane that they charged and convicted Luke. And I know you've seen it all and you still feel that way. But I think that the next step that we usually take in this process on our show here is, the next step we do is go through what was the prosecution's case, and then we'll go through the defense case and figure out, you know, what they got wrong. So if you're okay with that, we'll connect again next week, and we will talk about the prosecution's case and how Luke was convicted.
Absolutely. I'm here for any questions. If there's anything anybody doesn't understand, just let me know.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Lean, and we look forward to talking again next week.
Thank you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at putthemina.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of createdintandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. Doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod, and I can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.